And casting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Welcome to our FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. This week is a conclusion of a two-part series as Mike Seymour chats with Paul Franklin from Double Negative Visual Effects about the work they did for Batman Begins. Before we get to Mike's conversation, we'd like to thank two Flame artists who've kindly donated their voiceover and musical talents. Our new theme music is an original composition by Darren Hanley. He's both a musician and experienced designer, Flame and After Effects artist. If you'd like to hear more of Daz's music, check out www.manyarehere.com. Henry Birdseye is our voiceover talent. He's a freelance Flame and After Effects artist whose most recent side project can be found at www.fractaldvd.com. Links to both of their sites can be found on the FX Podcast section on FXGuide.com. Now, without further ado, let's go to Mike Seymour.
Welcome to part two of FX Guide's talk about Batman Begins. We have Paul Franklin with us, and he's been sharing some of the discussions of the process of filming and compositing and finalizing the shots for Batman Begins. I think you did about 350 shots, is that right, if I got my numbers right?
It's about 300, actually.
Out of about 570?
Yeah, there was about 570 shots in the movie in total, I think, according to Dan told me that. Dan Glass said that. I think, you know, a lot of those were things like digital opticals and rig removals. So I'd say there's, you know, we did a fairly decent chunk of the tricky stuff.
Look, I said it before, and I really think it's excellent work. I mean, it really is. It's both beautifully art directed and seamless, and from compositing through. And it wasn't until I started doing some research for this interview that I realized some of the work that you'd put into it. I was wondering if we could swing to the sort of source material, which was the filming of the stills or still sets in Chicago that were used for the basis of the backgrounds. Could you walk us through the steps there?
Well, there was a couple of things were obviously important to us at the outset. Was first off, this movie didn't use a digital intermediate. It was all graded the old way in the lab. And Chris Nolan and his director of photography, Wally Pfister, very keen to preserve the integrity of the negative and the color space that they were shooting in. And they were a little bit concerned that we were going to be originating a lot of material via digital stills, because we told them, we'd expressed the intention to shoot all of our textures and background plates using digital SLRs, the combination of Canon 10Ds, Canon D60s, and Canon 1D Mark IIs. And so at the outset, what we decided to do was totally overhaul our color pipeline so that we could use digital material but then put it into color space which matched what we were getting from the negative. And this was the first show that we implemented a fully open EXR pipeline from end to end using the open EXR file format that ILM produced a few years ago. Great thing about OpenEXR is that it supports HDR, high dynamic range, and it's also very efficient and very straightforward to use. It's also it's quite well understood now in terms of how to actually work with the file format. And we thought this would be a great way of preserving all of the information that was both in the negative in our scans from original main unit photography and also in the digital material. So we set about creating a series of 3D color cubes, which could be applied to our viewing tools. We have a series of viewing tools at Double Negative, which allow us to look at material in linear color space. So everybody on the movie on a Double Negative worked in linear color space in 32-bit float OpenEXR. So that's the 3D guys, the 2D guys, all working in the same color space and all viewing everything through the same viewing tools, which would apply these 3D lookup tables in real time, which then gave us a good idea for what it would actually look like when it was projected in final film space. That made a big difference to the way that we were actually working.
So what was the what was the real-time 2K playback that was doing that? Because that's obviously a fairly useful tool.
Well, we had, in terms of real-time playback, we couldn't actually stream stuff off the discs in real time. But what we had is a series of tools which were written for us by one of our lead TDs here, a guy called Ken McGaw, who's been with us for a while. Ken also worked at Weta for a while on the Lord of the Rings movies, and then before that he was at Industrial Light and Magic. And Ken came up with a couple of different viewers, a thing called GIT, which is stands for General Image Tool, but also amuses everyone because it's a North Country insulting name. And GIT allows us to look at things, again, like I say, looking at the linear color space, but then applying the 3D lookup in real time so that you get a good impression of what's actually going on. You can also scrub the exposure on everything because everything's in high dynamic range, so we can look at the low lights and look at the highlights. And we also have another tool called Slip. And Flip. Slip is the QuickTime player. Flip is a real-time playback tool which allows us to play 1K, stream it off the disc in near real-time, and then give us real-time playback on the machine to actually look at sequences. And it has all the same features as GIT in terms of supporting the high dynamic range and also the 3D color lookups.
So in terms of the high dynamic range stuff, can I take you back to Chicago and the source material? Because it was pretty interesting, the panoramas and sequencing that you were doing there. You mentioned before that you're using the Canon 10D digital SLRs, but you were bracketing shots and stitching them together, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Well, in order to make sure that our digital material had the same exposure range that was in the negative, you know, obviously a single digital exposure doesn't capture much more than, I think it's about plus or minus one stop of latitude, whereas a good fat neg will have 7.5 stops at least, or even 10 stops if you're lucky. So we realized that we were going to have to shoot all of our material bracketed across a wide exposure range. And then because Chris Nolan favors doing everything on quite long lenses, you know, his typical Chris Nolan lens when shooting anamorphic will be 100mm. We would have to actually shoot the panoramas in very high detail. So we would mount 50mm lens onto the Canon 10D body, which equates to 100mm anamorphic if you take into account the size of the film back on the Canon 10D. And then we would shoot these big tiled panoramas, which for a 360-degree panorama that's also tilted with tilting up quite far and tilting down quite low, that takes quite a long time to actually capture all that. But each tile in the panorama would be anything up to 6 exposures deep. So you would shoot 6 exposures at 2-stop intervals, which would cover a full 10-stop range. So you might end up with anything up to 600 images in a single panorama that you're actually shooting. Then to put all this material together, we would bring it back to double negative, and we had a couple of proprietary tools. There was a tool called Super Browser, which is essentially the front end to our stitching process, and this allows us to collate all of the images, arrange all the stacked exposures in the correct way. It then stabilizes the exposures against each other, because sometimes we were on rather unstable platforms. Like, for instance, one day I was on top of a condor crane in a high wind shooting a panorama, so the condor was swinging around like a giant metronome. It was deflecting a good 6 or 7 feet either direction. So even though it was in broad daylight, this for one of the daylight scenes, and I was using pretty short exposures, pretty short shutter time, should I say, the thing was swinging about and the images weren't registered properly against each other. So Super Browser allows for all that. It stabilizes the images, and then it compounds everything down into a single OpenEXR with an arbitrary exposure that setting that you can define at that point. Super Browser then takes all of the compounded frames and exports them to another tool, which is called STIG. And STIG is essentially a resolution-independent stitching tool. It's similar in a lot of respects to the functionality of tools like RealViz's Stitcher and various other panoramic stitching tools which are out there on the market. But we couldn't find anything that would support both the high dynamic range, wouldn't support OpenEXR, and we couldn't find anything that would be resolution independent, because it was important that we retained all of the information in these panoramas, because we didn't know at the outset where Chris was going to point his camera. So this is why we came up with this very comprehensive approach to covering our locations in Chicago. So we had to preserve all the information in the panoramas. So what STIG does is it doesn't actually export a single panoramic image from this stitching process. It actually exports shake scripts and instruction sets which tell you to how to reassemble the panorama from the original source material. This then can be read directly into Shake through some plugins that we have, which then just basically take the bit of the panorama that you actually need to look at in your comp. And in the case of the 3D stuff, when we're using it for texturing, we have an intelligent texture DSO, which again pulls out the relevant bit of the panorama that needs to be projected onto a piece of geometry, rather than trying to load an enormous, you know, 50K resolution panorama, which would just be impossible to deal with. So there was a lot of work was put into our workflow management to be able to manage the sheer amount of data that was going through the whole pipeline. And in total, I think, you know, we spent 6 weeks out in Chicago just basically hosing the whole place down with the digital SLRs, and then also shooting a lot of stuff on the sets in the UK and also the miniatures. And in total, I think we shot in excess of 1.25 million exposures, which went into all our panoramas, so that we would basically have a big virtual recording of all the locations and all the miniatures that to make the shots later on.
Wow. And not only that, but when you brought them back, you weren't just even using them as like straight projections onto an inside of a sphere or something. You actually had some intelligence in deriving 3D models and patching behind models, didn't you?
Yes. Well, because we started off with this photographic process, originally all started from the point of view that, well, it was one of Chris's original kind of edicts on the film, which is that he didn't want to have high resolution detailed digital architecture in the foreground of any shots, because he just felt it wasn't going to hold up. He wanted to always proceed from a photographic basis. This is why we developed the panoramic stitching pipeline. But later on, it became apparent that we were going to have to create digital architecture. And the guys who put together the stitching pipeline also came up with a series of photogrammetry tools, which allowed us to basically compare multiple views of an architectural scene, find correspondence points, and then recover the geometry from the photographs. It would also recover the actual positions of the cameras and then allow us to reproject the photographic panoramas back onto the geometry that had been recovered. So it was a pretty comprehensive solution in that respect. Similar in a lot of ways to the things that Paul DeBevic and his team had done at Berkeley University a few years ago with their development of the Facade software, which then also, I think, inspired a lot of the work that was done on the Matrix movies.
And am I right in saying that you actually went to the extent of also doing stuff with the interiors of the rooms?
Yeah, we did. Of course, all the buildings have lots and lots of windows in them. You know, a big modern city like Chicago is pretty much defined by reflective glass surfaces. During the daytime, that's fine, because what you're mainly seeing is just the reflections of the exterior world. But at night, the buildings are defined by the illumination inside the windows. And the color temperatures of the windows, the kind of patterns you're seeing in through the windows, and also the patterns of the windows on the facades of the buildings are what actually define the shapes of the structures. If you just randomly pepper the buildings with illuminated windows, you can't actually see the shapes of the buildings. It just looks like you're looking into space, into a galaxy or something like that. And you know, on location in Chicago, you could see that the buildings were defined by big blocks of kind of cool blue fluoro lighting fixtures, or warm tungsten domestic fixtures inside buildings which are residential buildings, for example. And of course, we get quite close to these buildings, so quite often we can see inside the rooms, and we can see the interiors parallaxing past as the camera travels past the buildings. So rather than try and build those as actual detailed geometry, which is just going to be an absolute killer, because, you know, some of the shots that we finally produced have many thousands of windows in them, it would just be a non-starter to build all those rooms as geometry. We shot panoramic images inside a selection of offices here in London. We actually, I think we documented about 80 or 90 different office spaces, which we shot using a Sigma 8mm wide-angle lens, which gives, on the Canon 10D, gives you about 120 degrees field of view. And then our shader writers came up with a very clever texture hack, which basically you would put this panoramic image, the wide-angle image, onto a single plane, which then sat in the window space. But the shader was able to calculate which bit of the texture to send to the camera based upon the ray projected from the camera to the plane. So it would know that, okay, the the ray from the camera is hitting the window surface at this point, therefore I should show this bit of the texture. And this really saved a huge amount of time because it gave us detailed high dynamic range room interiors, which we could control the exposure because, again, we were using our HDR photography process for all of this stuff. But essentially, you were just rendering a single plane with a texture on it. So it was a very, very efficient method of doing things.
Was that the Imrie Vision so-called pipeline?
No, that was actually the window tool was actually referred to as Window Box, which was written by one of our shader developers here, a chap by the name of Dan Evans. Imrie Vision is another version of another application of the projection texture projection toolset that I mentioned earlier on. And basically, what it was is we had several different ways of creating the architecture, from just straightforward matte painting in the background to very, very detailed, fully 3D textured buildings which played in the extreme foreground. But in some cases, we used a camera projection method, which is, again, it's a fairly established technique. You know, people have been using this for a little while, and we've used it. I think the first time I used it was on a movie called Enemy at the Gates to recreate Stalingrad a few years ago. But Imrie Vision was basically our lead environmental artist, a chap by the name of Imrie Watson. Imrie took this technique and raised it to such a level and turned it into such a nicely encapsulated little toolset pipeline that we'd said, well, okay, this is a new toolset in its own right. And so we named it after him, and thus it was called Imrie Vision. And Imrie Vision basically allowed us to take location plates and reproject them onto the architecture that we'd recovered from the plates. And it had things like features like intelligent shaders, which when you baked out the textures onto the architecture, it would flag up where all the occlusion problems were, where you were missing data, and then it had another bunch of tools which allowed you to fill in the missing data. And it also provided for things like the ability to remove reflections from windows which were already in the plates and then replace them with the window box tools that I've just been talking about.
Wow, that really shows a lot of R&D development, and obviously it paid huge dividends in the ability to pull off some of those shots.
The key thing was to have a range of solutions to all the various problems. I think if we'd have just gone in there saying, okay, we're going to do this all as matte painting, or, you know, conversely, if we're going to do this all as highly detailed 3D architecture, you know, we'd have been in real trouble, I think, because the amount of work that was thrown at us, particularly in the last few months of the post-production cycle, when Chris Nolan was getting more and more confident about what it was that we could actually do, and he was getting more comfortable with the whole idea of having fully digital scenes in his movie, you know, he then started creating new shots, which were fully digital shots, because obviously there was no chance to go back to Chicago and shoot more material. I think if we'd have just tried a single strand approach to our digital city, we would have been we'd have had problems.
We're talking to Paul Franklin from Double Negative about Batman Begins. I'm wondering now if we could turn to the other tricky problem, which you really nailed, which was actually producing a digital stunt double and some of the technologies that were involved there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, as with all things on this film, Chris Nolan was really keen that it shouldn't turn into a computer-generated cartoon. And as such, the majority of the stunt work you see in the movie is real. It's all in camera. It's Buster Reeves and the rest of the stunt department doing some amazing work. You know, there's a shot which a lot of people think is computer-generated, where you see Batman standing on the very top of an extremely tall building in Gotham City as the helicopter flies around him. And apart from it just being a digital optical conversion from VistaVision and reformatted as anamorphic, you know, that's completely in camera. But it became apparent as photography progressed that there were certain things that the practical stunts couldn't really do. And this mainly revolved around issues involving the Batcape. So getting the Batcape to deploy into the flying Batwing shape seamlessly in a single shot, particularly if Batman was performing a stunt at that point, just didn't really work. The special effects guys came up with this fantastic flying Batcape rig that was powered by compressed air. A little compressed air bottle would fill little hollow tubes in the cape. They would spring out rigid and it would adopt the Batwing shape. And that worked really well. But it didn't really have enough strength to overcome the slipstream of a stunt performer performer jumping off a building, so you couldn't get it to go from the loose cape to the rigid cape in one go. So that's where we played our digital stunt double in moments like that. Also, there were a couple of other things. For instance, when we see Batman hanging under the train, and you see Batman and the train in the same shot, and he's zooming through the streets, that's digital stunt double work, because obviously we didn't have a full-size practical train that could be played there. And also, the camera is traveling so fast, the train's traveling at about 100, well, between 150 and 200 miles an hour, that it just wasn't practical to try and rig that sort of thing. So again, digital stunt doubles made sense in those situations.
So if we can just sort of bore down on that, I think just discussing with the cape, you used Cyflex, did you? The software program that I think the Framestore used on the Thousand Greek Armada in Troy. And I think you've used it yourself in other projects before this, haven't you?
Yeah, we had some experience of Cyflex on our work for the Chronicles of Riddick. We did a bunch of work creating the Judi Dench character in that film, Arion, who kind of had all these complex flowing robes, which we had to recreate digitally in order to drive some of the visual effects elements that we were creating for the character.
I've just got to interrupt you there to tell you how great I thought that sequence was. I mean, I think that shot that you're talking about in the spaceship with the Judi Dench just absolutely nailed it. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I had to say I really admired that shot when I saw it, and it was great.
Thank you very much. That made the guys very happy. They worked long and hard on that one. It was quite a tricky one to nail. But, we were very pleased with the way it all turned out.
So did you just use Cyflex? Was it the same? Did you extend it? Is it off the shelf?
The big difference was that for Riddick, we weren't actually ever rendering the surfaces that we were generating with Cyflex. We were using them to drive particle systems to create all the kind of vaporous effects for that sequence. For Batman, obviously, we needed to see the cape, and it needed to have the same characteristics as the practical Batcape, which is a much more fluid and mobile piece of costume than it has been in the previous movies, where it had a much more heavy sort of rubber sheet kind of feel to it. In this movie, the Batcape is more like parachute silk with a very, very fine kind of brushed velvet surface on the outside, which gives these interesting, very, very low-level kicks off it. But at the same time, it's very, very distinctive, and it has almost sort of brittle quality in some places. It's quite stiff material in some respect. So it was quite complex to simulate. And this really pushed the limits of what we were able to do with Cyflex in terms of imparting detail to the Batcave. We wrote some additional hooks into Cyflex. We wrote our own geometry caching tool. So rather than using the native Cyflex geometry caching tools, just to be able to handle the complexity and also things that plugged better into our rendering pipeline. And then the Batcape, the look of the Batcape was completed with some very nifty shaders that were developed by our senior shader developer, Samson Cow. And Sam came up with a really cool BRDF pipeline, which we used for all of the Batman costume.
I'm really keen to follow that, but before we just get into the BRDF shaders, maybe you should just walk us through the actual pipeline in terms of the use of Maya, I believe, and Shake, and what the file formats were that were moving through.
Yeah, sure. I mean, our backbone 3D here at Double Negative is Maya, which we've been using since 1998 on our first project, which was a movie called Pitch Black, actually the first of the Riddick movies. And over the years, we've developed quite a lot of software that sits on top of Maya. We use Maya in conjunction with RenderMan as our primary rendering package. We also have some Mental Ray licenses and also the Maya renderer, as well as our own proprietary in-house rendering tools, DNA and DNB. The primary compositing package is Shake. And one of the key bits of proprietary software in the 3D pipeline is a tool called Rex, which is basically the bridge between Maya and RenderMan. We used it to replace mTOR, which we had been using the Maya to RenderMan plugin made by Pixar. So we swapped that out with Rex on Batman Begins, mainly because we wanted something which would give us a certain degree of flexibility and ability to control multipass rendering, and so we were able to spend a bit of time writing our own custom solution to that.
Were you favouring a multi-pass rendering approach on this, or was it really the case that you were kind of taking the, I think, Weta Golem approach, which was let's pretty much nail it in 3D and then pass that as a almost complete, albeit OpenEXR file, through to the compositors.
That is, we definitely do favour that approach. One of the great things is because we had all our colour tools not locked down, and because the 3D artists were actually rendering and lighting in the same colour space that the compositors were using and actually viewing them through the same tool. So basically a 3D artist knew that if they rendered something and they handed it off to the compositor, if the compositor didn't do anything to it, in other words, just didn't apply any filtering or any kind of treatment to the element, then it would look exactly the same as it had done when they looked at it in their 3D viewers. That means that you can confidently light stuff in 3D and get the look working in 3D, knowing that, okay, if I nail it here, then it's going to work. And if the compositors can concentrate on the stuff which, you know, is really important in the shot. They can concentrate on, you know, adding all the little bells and whistles, all the gags, all the integration of the live action elements, which really make the shots sing and dance, rather than spending a lot of time, you know, dealing with technical issues of trying to swing color spaces around so that everything lines up properly. And so we do use multi-pass rendering in as much as, you know, we render a beauty pass, we might render a highlights pass, we might possibly render a reflections pass, and then we'll render a bunch of utility passes like height and depth and geometry IDs and things like that, perhaps normal passes. But we don't really go with the idea of breaking the beauty pass down into, say, 10 or 15 separate layers of different layers of dirt and diffuse rendering and all that sort of thing, which I think it's just you're just putting off making decisions to a later stage. And if you have the ability to make the decisions and you're able to look at things as they're going to finally look on film at an early stage, then, you know, why not take advantage of that and make use of the skills of your artists?
Well, let me go back now to your BRDF functions, or for those people that don't know, they're bidirectional reflectance distribution functions. And these are obviously ways of measuring or mapping the relationship between incoming irradiance when it hits a surface and the reflected light. And of course, that's something that can be measured. Were you actually using a model where you were actually measuring a bunch of surfaces? I mean, this was obviously for the bat suit you mentioned before.
People had done on previous movies. Yannick and Dan had both worked on the Matrix sequels, and obviously were very familiar with the work that had been done at ESC measuring BRDF values using, I believe, a gonio reflectometer, which is a very expensive piece of kit. But we were looking at, just before we started Batman, our work on Batman Begins, there was some papers published at SIGGRAPH which came up with alternative methods of measuring BRDF values that essentially, you basically take the materials and you can wrap them onto cylindrical or spherical surfaces and then photograph them through polarizing light filters to actually get all the values for the way the light reflects off the materials. And then from the values that you sampled, you can then build up functions which then essentially simulate this inside the 3D shaders. And we found this to be extremely useful for the Batman costume, because the costume, it's really quite a complex thing. It's actually made of a combination of different types of foamed latex and neoprene. It's not all one uniform material, because in the movie the idea is that Bruce Wayne has assembled the suit itself from various different sources, so there are slight differences between all the different materials. Like the cowl, for example, is a noticeably different texture from the rest of the torso of the bat suit.
Now, did they just give you a bat suit? You just have one in the office, do you?
We got bits of one later on, but to begin with, the security on the bat suit design was so extreme that you could only go and see it at a place which was referred to by the crew as Cape Town, which was basically a little bat suit fabrication shop built on some spare ground behind Shepperton Studios. And you had to go through a whole bunch of security gates and go past guard dogs, I'm really not joking here, to get to this thing. And it's like a little village made of a little prefab hut built out on this vacant lot behind the studio. And because they were worried that press photographers from the British tabloid press were constantly trying to get pictures of the Batsuit, and in fact any designs of the movie, they'd roof the whole thing over with a giant tin roof to prevent people seeing it from helicopters. So we'd go in there, we were allowed access to the bat suit there. We weren't allowed to take one away with us. We were just given tiny little swatches of the materials from the bat suit. So we ended up with this pack of about 10 different pieces of near identical black synthetic rubber. And it was quite a bit of detective work to try and work out, okay, well, is this the shoulder? Is this the chest? You know, is this the cowl? All these sorts of different things, trying to work it backwards to put it all together. But eventually we managed to sort it all out and put the thing together. And I think the results were very, very good, because the bat suit had this kind of very complex quality in that it's quite matte, but at the same time it has this sort of strange oily slickness to it. And it actually kicks off quite a lot of reflections and things like that. So all the effort that was put into the BRDF measurement and the whole shader development pipeline was well worth it in the end, I think.
Did you actually have enough material to sample them correctly? Did you actually, you know, have any problems with getting accurate readings?
To begin with, we had some problems because they supplied some very, very small swatches of some of the materials. But they were pretty helpful, the guys in the wardrobe department, and they supplied us with everything that we needed in the end. So it was very good. And then later on, when things were kind of relaxed slightly, they actually gave us larger pieces of the costume, and they gave us access to the costumes, and we did a lot of detailed photo documentation of all the costume components.
So, of course, this kind of, you know, diffuse multi-scattering stuff that's gathered through this process is also, you know, related to the subsurface scattering that I believe you used on the chin or the exposed skin of Batman himself in the same shots.
Yeah, Batman's, you know, there isn't much exposed skin in the Batman costume. There's just a little bit of Batman's face there. And the original expectation was that we were never going to have to play this particularly close to camera, but in actuality, we did get quite close to the face there, and you probably could fudge it and get away with stuff that doesn't use subsurface scattering. But we found that the result that we got by implementing a subsurface scattering shader made such a big difference to things that it just was like a no-brainer to actually to use that. And we were very lucky that Ken McGaw, who I mentioned earlier on, he had done a lot of work developing the shaders for Gollum over at Weta, and recently gained an Academy certificate of for his special technical achievement from basically a technical Oscar for having helped develop subsurface scattering, and that really did help developing all that stuff.
We spoke to the Weta guys around that time, and they ended up, I remember saying how surprised I was that they'd used subsurface scattering on just about everything, like elephants, everything, because it got such great results. The team from that had drifted up to you, and or had you sort of deliberately gone down and hired ex-Weta people?
Well, Ken McGaw had worked for us. Before he worked for Weta, he actually worked at Double Negative on a movie called Below, where he'd developed a lot of our underwater environmental pipeline for that show. It's a submarine movie set in the Second World War. So we were quite keen to get for Ken to rejoin the team, and we were very lucky that he did. But we also got guys. We had fantastic shader writers. I mentioned Sam Cow, who worked on the show as well. Sam had done a lot of work at Industrial Light and Magic, as well as also at Weta. And then in house, we had some great shader writers on the show as well. A chap called Martin Hill, who strangely went off to Weta from here recently. So, and Dan Evans, who developed the window box pipeline.
Now, I'm really amused by this, because not only did you go to such enormous lengths to actually measure the materials of, 12 or whatever different shades of black, but then, of course, you got Buster to go through enormous lengths to jump off buildings just so you'd have some actual real-world reference.
Yes, this all comes from Chris Nolan's insistence on everything being as realistic as possible. He didn't ever want the digital stunts to look like Batman had suddenly developed superhuman strength and was capable of flying or whatever. You know, when he flies, it's because he's got a super high-tech hang glider. It's not that he's able to flap his arms and levitate off the ground, sort of Superman style. And as such, the stunt department arranged a series of reference stunts for us, and one day we managed to get Buster up on top of one of the large structures at the Cardington set, which is a nine-story building that's built inside the big aircraft hangar that was used to house the sets there. And Buster did a wire jump off the side of the building down onto a big airbag below, wearing the bat cape. And he repeated this jump for us, I think, about 10 times in total. And we had all I've got, like, basically all of our match movers and 3D artists down for the day, and so we videotaped the whole thing from 10 different positions as witness camera material. And that was really the way that we approached all of the animation on for the digital stunt doubles. Is we didn't use any motion capture. Everything you see in the film is completely keyframed, but it was always based on scrupulously observed reference material, whether it was outtakes of Buster on the wire flying down the street through the steam plumes, or special stuff that Buster did for us, like that stunt jump where the stunt department were very helpful to us. And we also even got Buster to do a whole bunch of moves in front of a blue screen for us to give us reference for how the bat suit actually deformed and changed shape, and what kind of limits it imposed on his movement when he was actually doing his fighting and stunt action.
Well, we've been talking to Paul Franklin at Double Negative about their work on Batman Begins, and I'd like to say thank you again for spending this time with us. It's been absolutely brilliant. Great work on the film. We've all enjoyed it tremendously, and I look forward to hopefully many sequels.
Yes, we do too. I mean, it was a great show to work on, you know, because we started, as I say, with at the outset with Chris Nolan saying that he didn't want things like digital architecture and digital stunt doubles in his film, and then we end up with a situation where the last shot of the movie is a digital stunt double against an entirely digital cityscape. So it was a great experience for us in terms of developing ourselves as a facility and working with some very interesting filmmakers. And yeah, roll on the sequels.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2005 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.